Okay, so I guess we can start this evening's talk. And tonight I'm going to talk about impermanence. This word, impermanence, is a very central word in the Buddha's teachings, a very important part of how we look at the world from a Buddhist point of view. So it's a very core aspect of what we do, in a sense, as Buddhists, how we look at the world, how we deal with our lives, this idea of impermanence. And sometimes the word impermanence itself, it comes from a Pali word, which is anicca. Pali, of course, being one of the most original languages that Buddhism was originally proclaimed in, pretty much very close to how the Buddha himself taught the Dhamma 2,500 years ago. And the word he used was anicca in that language. And sometimes when you translate a word from Pali into English, you lose some of the nuances of that word, right? When you translate in one way, you call it impermanence, you may lose other aspects, because words never map one-to-one from one language to another one. And some of the other ways of looking at anicca is not just impermanence, but you have words like being irregular, right? Something which isn't constant. Even things like unreliable is actually a good translation of the idea of anicca. Things which are unreliable, right? Things which you can't rely on in this world. And to me, the idea of unreliable is often has a much more powerful emotional ring to it than impermanence. If something is unreliable to me, it's bad, right? If you have an unreliable friend, how do you feel about that? You're not really sure. Okay, maybe they're becoming an ex-friend at the moment. They start to become unreliable, right? Friendship is part of that. Is about reliability, about being able to trust somebody. So unreliable to me is very bad. So you have this broad spectrum of meanings, and they really all combined into this term anicca, or impermanence. Uncertainty is another one. Things are uncertain. You don't know what's going to happen next. Things are always subject to change, moving around, ceasing, coming to an end, whatever it is. So this is to give you some idea of the spectrum of this word. Now, Even though anicca, impermanence, is a very important part of the Buddhist teaching, very central to Buddhism, and I think impermanence in many ways is very intuitive, right? We grasp impermanence quite easily because we can see impermanence in the world around us with a fair amount of ease if you want to. But it's also very profound, and this is the difficult part of it, is to go from a superficial acceptance of this to deepen it in our life and to understand this idea more profoundly. This is really the hard part, and this is what the Buddhist practice is all about. It starts off with understanding it in a fairly simple way, and then integrating it into our life, and eventually understanding it in the most profound way possible. And that understanding of anicca in the most profound way, that actually is one of the ways of understanding the idea of awakening itself. A full understanding of impermanence actually is nothing else but awakening, seeing of the world as it actually is, awakening to the truth of existence. Before I maybe start to talk about how to deal with this in our ordinary life, how to reflect on this, I just want to talk a little bit from the viewpoint of the Buddha, how the Buddha talks about impermanence in the suttas. Suttas are the word of the Buddha, the discourses of the Buddha. One of the ways of understanding this is how it integrates with the other factors of the Buddhist path. Now, some of the other factors of the Buddhist path, one of the obviously important ones that we always hear about in Buddhism, one of the reasons why Buddhism is sometimes called pessimistic, is the idea of suffering, dukkha in Pali language. And there's a very close relationship between the ideas of anicca, impermanence on the one hand, and dukkha on the other hand. Suffering and impermanence are very, very closely related to each other. And it's important to understand that relationship. Why is it, the Buddha always says, whatever is impermanent is suffering? So why is that the case? Why is what is impermanent suffering? And it's very simple, right? One of the reason why that is the case is because One of the aspects of being a human being is that we attach to things in the world. We grasp onto things. We pick things up. We take up views in our life. We attach to material possessions. We attach to relationships. All of these kind of things. But if things are impermanent, if things are always changing, if things are always ceasing, if things are unreliable, and you attach to unreliable things, if you attach to your unreliable friend, right? But it's actually not people who are unreliable. It's nature that is unreliable. Nature is changeable. So when you attach to that, you suffer as a consequence because it gets pulled out of your grasp as soon as you attach to it. Not as soon as you attach to it, but once you have attached to it, sooner or later, it's going to be pulled out of your grasp. And then you suffer because of that. So suffering and impermanence are two sides of the same coin. One must lead to the other. As soon as you attach to something, you're asking for trouble. Right? It's one of those, it's one of those weird things, because it's kind of very different from how people often look at the look at life, but actually, from a Buddhist point of view, as soon as you attach to something, you're asking for trouble. You're asking for suffering somewhere down the line. So suffering and impermanence are intertwined like this. But it's also intertwined with this other very profound, even more profound perhaps, teaching of Buddhism. And this is kind of the teaching, again, around which the deepest insights on the Buddhist path, they all revolve around this. And this is the teaching of Buddhism we call non-self, anatta in Pali language. So why is it that anatta and impermanence, why is it that they are non-self and impermanence, why is it that they are related to each other? And the reason is because the whole idea of a sense of self is the idea, first of all, of being able to control things. Right? The self is what controls the world. We exercise our choices. We exercise our ability to do things in the world, to get things in a certain way. And then impermanence says, no, you're not going to get your way. So impermanence undermines that whole sense that we are in charge and we can control things in the world. So whenever you feel that you are in control, in charge, be careful. That's a delusion. It's an illusion. You're not really in charge. And that too is going to be, it's going to be shown to you sooner or later if you just keep on looking at it and investigating it. And the other aspect is that the idea of self revolves around this feeling that there is something essential to existence, right? There's something essential which I call me. I exist. I am somebody. I am. And this sense of I that each one of us has inside of us, it actually reflects a certain wrong view about something being permanent. It may not be obvious to you, you may not even be able to see that, but that actually is what is the case from a Buddhist point of view. So once you start to see impermanence, this idea of non-self also links in with that. So this is very powerful stuff, and very useful also to start reflecting on, because it guides you in the right direction on the Buddhist path. And the last aspect of the Buddhist teaching that impermanence links in with is the idea that things are conditioned, right? Things are not, things don't stand alone like something solid, something always existing. This is what the sense of self tells us. Things are existing. Things kind of, you know, things are solid. They can be kind of relied on again. But no, everything is conditioned. What we are as human beings, we are the sum, really, of the causes and conditions that always always impinge on us from the outside. We are the sum of all those things. Coming from the past, from a Buddhist point of view, even past lives are a part of this, right? All of these things come into being, and that is what we are, the person we are right now. And this is a very interesting way of looking at the world, because when you understand that everything is just causality, everything is conditionality, it does something to you. It changes our outlook. It changes our the way we deal with the world, the way we deal with ourselves. And it has very important implications for that reason. And I want to talk about some of those implications here tonight. What this actually does to us when we take on board the idea of impermanence in a much more deep fashion than perhaps we're used to. So this is the idea, and as I said, it is really, it is a very profound teaching, but it also has some very, it is also very obvious in a certain way. It makes a lot of intuitive sense to us that things are impermanent, things are changing. Very briefly, you know, if you think about society around us, kind of the world around us, you can see, right, how things are always changing around you. The world around us always changing. You look at this planet, you look at the cities, you look at the city of Perth, right, how it's growing and becoming larger all the time. And this is true for cities around the world. Right, I remember seeing a picture of Perth from the 1960s, and it was very different from what it is now. It was just this little town. Now it's like becoming a large city. You can see this transition happening all the time. And of course, you see things happening in the natural environment, right? You see climate change happening. The summers are getting hotter. The oceans are rising. You see all of these things happening in the world around us. And one of the things, of course, one of the natural responses that we often have is that a lot of these things, many of these changes are kind of frightening, right? They're a bit worrying. You read about things like climate change and nobody really knows exactly what's going to happen, if it's going to be very bad or just a little bit bad or exactly what it is. But it's kind of concerning. And one of the things that you start to realize when you do that, people start to want to find people to blame, right? And this is one of the things that sometimes when I read the newspaper, the West Australian or whatever it is, and you see about the failures in our society, so-called failures, of course it isn't really a failure at all. You see things like the bushfires that devastate so many families. You see kind of the power supply is not really reliable, right? People are complaining about the power supply. People are complaining about the police not doing their job, the crime rates are going up. And it's always about blaming people. We have this blame game. The world is changing. Impermanence is affecting us. This natural law of the way things have to be is affecting us. And our response is to blame people, to blame the world, to say they are not doing the job they should be doing. Right? This is often a response. And of course, one of the reasons, there's a couple of reasons why we respond like that. One of the reasons is because of, over the decades and the last few centuries, humanity has been very good at building up lots of technology, right? And I think a lot of that technological prowess that we have built up over the last couple of centuries or whatever it is has made us feel a little bit kind of invincible, this idea that we can do anything, we can control nature. We have already been controlling nature quite a bit, right? Building massive dams everywhere and trying to predict the weather and hurricanes and all these kind of things. And of course, some of that is good, some of it may not be so good. But we have had a lot of success. And because of that, I think we have these expectations that we are going to be able to tame nature, tame the world, and control everything here. So this is perhaps one of the obvious reasons why we feel that kind of impermanence shouldn't really be there. Things shouldn't be unreliable. We should be able to make everything, to control everything, to mold everything into our image. And the other one is, of course, the sense of self inside of us. And this is the ultimate reason why we think that we can control the world. Because we have an innate feeling that we are in charge. We are in control. This is our world, right? These are our people out there. These are the cities that we have built. If we have built all this stuff, if we have done all these things, then surely it means that we are ultimately in control. And because of that, we go out and we believe that we can control everything in the world ultimately. And then when things go wrong, we blame people. Somebody must be at fault, right? If we are in charge, if we are the choosers, if we have the ability to control the world, if things go wrong, the blame has to fall back on us. And this is why you always see in the papers people blaming each other, this blame game going around, saying who should be fired for the latest catastrophe, for the latest problems, for the latest whatever it is, whatever it is that doesn't work in our society here. So this is one of the problems, right? This blame game is a terrible thing. I think often it makes our society much more harsh when we're always blaming people. You're always finding a scapegoat. We are assuming that people are ultimately responsible for these things. But is that really so? And of course the Buddhist answer really is that no, in the end it isn't so. People too are part of this network of causality. People are what they are because of the cause and conditions in their life. And then they act in certain ways because of other cause and conditions. So in a sense, they too are victims. In a sense, they have very limited choice in their lives. They are kind of part of this stream, right? It's like this river of humanity rushing forward, society moving forward. And we are each like a drop, a molecule of water in this massive river rushing forward. And we are conditioned from all sides by all the other molecules, by the force of this river rushing forward. And there's actually very limited scope for action in us. And so this is a part of the problem, this kind of blame game that happens. And of course, we become risk averse, right? If you think that you're going to control the whole world, well, of course, you become risk averse. No risk is worth taking anymore because you think you can't control everything. And prices go up, insurance premiums go up, everything becomes expensive. This is another perhaps side effect of this controlling thing. But there's another way of looking at this. There's a better way of understanding all of this rather than thinking that we can control everything. And that is to remind ourselves of this basic Buddhist teachings. Things are unreliable by their very nature. Things have come into existence through unreliable causes. That's why they are there. Take away those unreliable causes because they too are impermanent. And then the results, the unreliable results, also cease as a consequence. So this is a beautiful way of looking at other human beings. Instead of blaming other human beings, understand that they too are a result of all these causes working on them. Instead of blaming the person, we'll try to find the source of the problem, right? Why did these things happen? Why did this person make this mistake? We can assume it wasn't really, they didn't really want to make that mistake, right? Or even if they wanted to, why did they want that? So we go to the source of the problem, and then when we go to the source of the problem, then we can actually change things rather than blaming people. Understand impermanence. Things must be unreliable. Sometimes you can't change things. Sometimes disaster will happen, and that is okay as well. And I think one of the great examples of this, I remember reading a few years ago a beautiful story. This was also in the West Australian, and there was a story about a judge who had worked in the north of WA for, I think he worked up there for a long time, several decades, I think, maybe in Broome or something like that. And he had worked in up there for a long time. And of course, he had seen a lot of bad things when you are a judge. One of the downsides of being a judge is seeing all the crime and all the negativity. But of course, being a judge also gives you a chance of doing good for society. And this judge, I was very, very impressed by his attitude. And he told this story. And he had written it into the West Australian. It was published in the West Australian. And he told the story of this Aboriginal kid that one day he was sitting, presiding in this court. And this Aboriginal kid was brought in, right? Kid, 10 years old, 12 years old, something like that. This very shy little kid, right? Didn't want to, couldn't really see and look anybody in the eye because he was too shy. And whenever he spoke, he kind of had this very low, very lack of confidence in him. No confidence in speaking in any kind of public setting, right, when there was anybody around. Even though it was just a courtroom, still this shyness. Right? And we know, you know, as an aside from the Buddhist teachings, you know that if you live an immoral life, a bad life, you tend to feel more shy, more withdrawn, not really confident in that kind of public situation. So he was there, and of course, as soon as he was brought into the court, this judge remembered this kid, right? This kid was coming in almost every month, because every month this kid had done something stupid, right? Like stealing something from a shop. Often just petty little offenses. But it was so regular that this kid would come back and back and back again. And very often, of course, the prosecution would demand he should be put into some kind of child detention, right? To kind of make sure he didn't mess around anymore. I'm not sure exactly how these things work. But this judge, he knew this child because it had come so often into the court. And he knew his history, he knew his background. He knew that he had never really had a father in his life, right? And the degree to which he had had a father, he was just abuse and difficulties all the time. He knew he had a mother who was an alcoholic, who had never really looked after him at all throughout his whole life. And because he knew that his childhood had been so incredibly difficult. What this child needed wasn't more punishment. This was this judge thinking. It wasn't more punishment. More punishment was just going to make things worse. All his life, all he had ever received was punishment. And looked where it had got him. Absolutely nowhere except for back into court again and again and again. So the judge thought, something else is required. What can we do? And then, because he was the presiding judge, because he was the one who was going to pass judgment and also the penalty, he said to this kid, I will make a deal with you. If you can stay out of trouble for 1 year, I will buy you a bicycle. Right? A bicycle doesn't sound like much, right? Kids these days have all kinds of stuff, but just a bicycle. This was back in the 1970s and 1980s. No doubt it was more valuable in those days. But to this kid, it meant a lot. Somebody's showing kindness to him, right? Somebody's doing something different for once. And the kid said, okay, 1 year, I can do that. And of course, the kid went out. A year passed by, and then they met up again after a year passed by. And of course, that kid had not been seen in court in that year. So the judge then, of course, being the man he is, a man of honor, he says, I will honor my promise to you. He takes him to this bicycle shop, and this kid chooses his bicycle. Of course, he chooses a nice and expensive bicycle. That's the way things usually go. But of course, he does that. He's very happy to pay for that bicycle for this kid. And he gives the kid the bicycle. And then the kid gets on his bicycle and sort of rides off into the sunset, right? And this is the real sunset. This is not the sunset of some kind of cowboy movie where everything, we have no idea what happens afterwards. This is the real sunset. He rides off. And the judge said many years later on, he met this Aboriginal kid and he had a steady job and he was doing well. And life had been, in a sense, turned around for this kid. So this shows you what can be done if we deal with the unreliability and the difficulties in life in the right way. It would have been easy for that judge to say, well, lock up that kid in some kind of, you know, safe place where he can't make any mess around anymore. And then, of course, that would be like the controller in us who wants to control things, right? These kids need to be controlled. Okay, we put him there. He can't do anything bad when he's there. And that will be the end of it. But this controller is lying to us. It doesn't work. And it had been shown already for so long with this kid that it wouldn't work. So there's another side of it which says there are causes and conditions. There are reasons why this kid is behaving in this way. Let's try to resolve the root problem rather than kind of try to resolve this in a superficial way. And of course, that is exactly what he did. He went to the root. He showed kindness. He showed compassion. He opened his heart to somebody who probably had very rarely received any kindness in their life. And when you show people kindness, you get a response, right? The response is you want to live up to that. You want to show that you're worthy of that kindness. Isn't that often the case? When people are kind to me, I feel, wow, I've got to be worthy of this. If I'm a monk, people come to the monastery every day and offer food to the monks. And I think, wow, I've got to live a good life as a monk. I can't just be a scallywag monk, right? A dodgy character, shady character, kind of, you know, hiding my head in shame when people aren't around or whatever. You've got to do a good thing. You live up to people's expectations when they are kind to you. Kindness is incredibly powerful. And I think if we live a society which understands causality more, instead of punishing people, instead of fault finding, instead of, you know, writing about people in the papers, finding scapegoats for all the problems in society, firing them, saying, you've been a bad person, instead, search for the root problems. It's not always going to work. We know that. Some people are not going to be affected by those kind of things. But very often it will work. And if we do that, I think we are building up a society which is more compassionate, more kind, who has a softer heart inside, and we don't become so harsh. Sometimes I feel disappointed. You know, you read in the paper people's opinions, and often it is too harsh, in my opinion. We're not going to create a nice society where we can relax and feel at ease if we are too harsh with each other. We need more understanding here. And with that understanding comes the solutions to many of the problems in society here. But anyway, that is society, right? Okay, you can say that with society it's too difficult, it is too hard. I'm just one small person. I don't know what I can do with society. I think each one of us, if we do what is right, we have an effect on the society around us. So it will help. But really, even more powerful than looking at society as such is to embrace the idea of unreliability and impermanence in our own lives. This is even more powerful. And again, it is very intuitive. I'm sure you will agree that if you look at your own life, you will see how unreliable things are, right? How impermanent things are, how things are always changing in your own life. You know, whatever property that you own, whatever house you have, whatever things you own in your life, you see how it's always deteriorating, always kind of going down, always becoming worse. You always have to kind of prop it up, right, to keep it going. The house needs a new coat of paint because the paint is falling off the walls, and gradually things are always kind of falling apart around you. I always like to, when I look at I live in this little hut in the forest at the Dhammapodinyana Monastery. It's great to live in a little hut in the forest. I can really recommend that. It's a wonderful thing to do. But what I like to look at this hut, it's actually a very solidly built hut. Double brick, concrete ceiling, concrete floor, right? When you go in there, it's like being in this cave, which is part of the idea as to how kind of a cave in the forest. But I also like to look at the impermanence of that little hut. Right? You start, as soon as this hut is built, you start to look at it, you start to see things kind of chipping in the corners. A brick is chipped here, a brick is getting loose, right? There's a little bit of rust perhaps on the steel rafters. Some of the paint is coming off the ceiling. There is the gutters aren't working properly, whatever it is. As soon as it is built, you can start to see it falling apart. And that is this metaphor for life, the metaphor for everything in our lives. So notice that. Take note of how everything all the time is falling apart in your life, gradually, gradually eroding, gradually, gradually falling apart. Right? That's life. That's how it is. If you deny it, you're going to suffer. Because if you deny it, you're living in a different world from reality. If you're living in a different world from reality, it's going to be problematic for you. There's going to be a clash between your ideas and the way the world actually is. So it's important to be realistic. This is part of what the idea of right view is about, being realistic about how the world works. And of course, external things, the physical things in your life which are impermanent, but a lot also of the other things in your life, more the things that are closer to you, your views, your emotions, and all of these things, the relationships you have in life, all of that too is impermanent, right? One of the great things, I think, to remember the impermanence of is your views. I think this is very powerful. I think we often think that our views of the world, we tend to think that we are right, right? Fair enough, we have to think you're right. If you didn't think you're right, you wouldn't have that view. So that's fair enough. But remember that your views themselves are conditioned. Why do you have a particular view? Why do you come here on a Friday night? Why do you think of yourself as a Buddhist? Why do you have a certain political leaning, right? Well, you think it's right, but remember, they are conditioned. These views exist because of how this network of conditions has given rise to them. They're not really solid. They're not absolute truths as such. It depends on how you look at things. Look at things slightly differently, and you stop being a Buddhist and you become a Christian, right? It's not such a massive change in outlook. I wouldn't recommend it, but sometimes it happens. So, and remember that, because when you remember that, it makes you a little bit more humble about your views. I remember when I was young, I'm now over 50, but I remember when I was in my kind of teenage years, in my early 20s, wow, I was so sure of myself. I thought I knew exactly how the world is, right? This is the right way, everybody else is wrong. I know what it's like. And I feel slightly embarrassed now by thinking about that. I feel jeepers, I was really stupid in those days. And now I see over the last 30 years how my views have kind of changed completely. In those days I wasn't a Buddhist even, I was kind of nothing really. And then gradually, now I'm a Buddhist. My political views have changed, everything has changed so much in that period of time. So remember that, your views are impermanent, they are unreliable, they are always changing. Yes, they feel true to you, but remember when somebody challenges you that they are only conditioned phenomena. It makes you a bit more humble, it makes you more able to listen when somebody else is speaking, it makes you not so confident about everything you believe in, and that, I think, is a very good thing. Too much confidence, I think, is a sign of ignorance in our lives. Humility about our views, humility about our understanding of the world is a positive and a good thing here. So that already is very good. It means that there's more clashes, we have less arguments with people because we have more humility about these things. Another idea which we often cling to, of course, is the idea of Buddhism. You know, you are perhaps a Buddhist, I don't know, probably some here today who don't really consider themselves a Buddhist. But let's say that you're interested in Buddhist teachings. Let's say you consider yourself a Buddhist, right? And then you look at the state of Buddhism in the world, and sometimes you think, gee, Buddhism is going downhill, right? Right here in Perth, it's quite strong, it's going very well. But if you kind of look at the general trend of Buddhism, you kind of think, wow, this is looking scary. Don't know where this is heading. How many more generations we have left, and maybe Buddhism will be completely gone. Now, what is our response to that when you see that unreliability even of something which is maybe so close to you, which is so important to your life, something that gives your life a sense of direction, a sense of meaning? That's what Buddhism is to me. It's something that gives my life a very clear sense of direction and a very powerful sense of meaning. I feel my life is very meaningful, and that's precisely because I'm a Buddhist, and also perhaps because I'm a monastic. But these two things obviously go together here. So what if this thing, which is so important to me, is impermanent? What should I do? And of course, one response, and this is one of the responses that you see around the world, one response is to say, well, this Buddhism is unreliable, I will look to the next Buddha. The next Buddha is probably coming soon. That is what I'm going to worship, because then I'm worshipping something, I'm honoring something that is certain, because we all know that the future Buddha will come one day. Some people call this future Buddha Buddha Maitreya, right? So Buddha Maitreya will come, he will be the new savior, and then I will get the teaching directly from this Buddha. Now I feel kind of a bit in the dark, there's no Buddha around, right? What a wonderful thing to get the teaching directly from the Buddha himself. So forget about Buddhism now, you know, it's all over anyway, and let's kind of look into the future and worship the future Buddha instead. And unfortunately, you see a lot of that happening around the world. You see this Buddha statues being built, you know, in so many different places in the world, these enormous Buddha statues costing tens of millions of dollars, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars, enormous things. Sometimes they have shopping centers inside, right? That shows you how that gives you some idea how dodgy it is, right? And this is how a large part of the Buddhist population out around the world is spending their time, honoring, worshipping some future Buddha that we don't know anything about. Yes, there will of course be a future Buddha, because future Buddhas, Buddha is just a natural phenomenon. Every now and again somebody reaches awakening by through the right practice, through the right way of looking at the world. So every now and again there will be a Buddha arising in the world. But the next Buddha, when is it going to be, right? We don't know when it's going to be. Are we going to be around when this Buddha arises? We have no idea. And if you get to meet the Buddha, would you recognize him as the Buddha? Probably not, right? You probably dismiss them. Yeah, whatever. And you you see this in one of the suttas, one of the discourses of the Buddha. This is exactly what happens. There is this disciple there, this really, this Brahmin, who, you know, who talks, and somebody wants to show him the new Buddha who has arisen in the world. And he says, yeah, whatever, not interested in that nonsense that this Buddha is talking about. So these are the problems. We are kind of looking, this is this pie in the sky, this possible Buddha of the future. We worship something we don't know anything about. It's madness. It's absolutely crazy. We have the beautiful teachings now. What impermanence, what unreliability rather should teach us is not to look towards something in the future we don't know anything about, but rather it should tell us that we have the teaching now, at this moment, this day, this life, it is all available to us. Now is the opportunity. Today is my opportunity to be kind to somebody. Today is my opportunity to say something nice to somebody. Today is my opportunity to have a kind thought, to practice these teachings in the right way. This is the right way of dealing with that unreliability. Not by worshipping something which is completely uncertain in the future. And also, I think personally, when we have these amazing teachings of the Buddha, it is a lack of gratitude to our Buddha, the Buddha who is already arisen in the world. It's a lack of gratitude towards him when we go worshipping something else which we have no idea about. These wonderful teachings are there. This very beautiful, peaceful man who lived in India 2,500 years ago. You can imagine him in your mind's eye. I like this kind of idea of imagining the Buddha. You see him in the forest in the north of India, sitting at the root of a tree. He looks like an ordinary man, right? And then you approach him, and you come into this presence of somebody who is so peaceful, right? Somebody who doesn't talk very much. But then when you engage this person in conversation, you feel a sense of profound compassion, understanding, wisdom. Right, it's powerful. Just imagine that 2,500 years ago. He is the one, this Buddha, who bequeathed us all these teachings that we now have today. They are available in the library right here, in the Dhammaloka Center. Go there, read some of those teachings. They are very powerful and very beautiful. And when you remember that, you feel a sense of gratitude towards this person. Somebody with a tremendous insight into the human condition, into what it is to be human. And then, I think, that is when you are on the right track. Forget about the future Buddha. If there is a future Buddha, allow that Buddha to come when time is right. And then we can talk about that Buddha. Not now. So this is some, again, ideas of how to deal with this idea of impermanence in our life. It's important to grasp these things in the right way and not to be silly about it. And so all of these things, right, in our life, our relationships, all our possessions, all our ideas, all the things we take up, our status in society, the religion we have, everything is impermanent. Everything is unreliable. So what can we do about this? What should we do? How can we live our life to deal with this in a better way? Well, the first thing that we perhaps need to ask, is there anything at all we can rely on? If everything is always changing, where can we stand? What can we do? It's one of those interesting things in Buddhism, is this idea that when you really understand impermanence in a profound way, in a profound sense, it is as if you understand that it's as if you're standing on the carpet that somebody is holding and somebody is going to pull out from under your feet at any one time, right? When somebody pulls out the carpet from under your feet, you fall, you stumble. And this is life. Life is like that because of the uncertainty of life, because everything is always unreliable. It's as if the carpet is always being pulled out from under your feet. You will stumble because you are attached to things. Those things you are attached to will eventually show their unreliability and impermanence, and then the carpet will be pulled away. So if the carpet is always being pulled away, if everything is so unreliable, what can we do? And the answer, of course, is, and this is one of the reasons why the Buddha's teaching is called a refuge, because it is precisely a refuge from the unreliability of the world. It's one of the few places you can go and you can get some guidance for how to deal with this. You go to the teaching of Buddhism, you go to wherever these teachings are found, and there you can come to understand how to deal with these things. This is why, one of the main reasons why we have this. And the first thing that the Buddha has to say about this is that just reflecting on it itself is very powerful. So remember to remind yourself of the problem of impermanence. Remember that things really are impermanent. Remember this in your daily life. The Buddha quite specifically says that we need to remember that everything that is dear and agreeable to me will become otherwise, will become different. Everything that is dear and agreeable to you will change, right? This is the first thing. And when you do that, every time you reflect like that, every time you take that a little bit deeper than before, and you remind yourself of all the things, right? Everything. So you can start to expand the circle of things that you that are unreliable. Start with the easy stuff so you don't feel too challenged, and gradually move out to the more difficult stuff. But when you think of that, you start gradually to detach a little bit. You don't hold on to those things so strongly anymore, because you understand that if you do, it will give rise to suffering. Yeah? But there's a very important counterbalance to that, because if you do detach from many of the things in the world, you have to find some other place to find security, to find happiness. If all our happiness is found in our belongings and our relationships, and you see those things as impermanent, you see those things as problematic, you have to find your happiness somewhere else. That is where the teachings of kindness, of morality, of goodness, of thinking kind words, of doing meditation practice, where all of that comes in. Because every time you do something kind, every time you avoid doing something bad, every time you have a kind thought and you develop your mind in compassion, understanding of the people around you, you're building up happiness, you're building up peace, you're building up contentment inside of you, you're building up a sense of independence. Right? And this is really a very important part of the Buddhist path, this independence that you start to feel inside of you after a while. The world doesn't matter so much anymore. The world can go this way or that way, but I still have this inside of me, this sense of solidity, this sense of freedom from the things around me. This is what you're building up. So these things have to go together, right? Reflecting on the one hand, yes, things, everything that is dear and agreeable to me, what are these things, right? Count them up. They are all unreliable. One side of the story, the other side. Act in a good way. And when you do those things together, you act in a kind and compassionate way in the world, and you reflect in the wise way, these two become two sides of a very powerful way of living here. And it gradually moves you in the right direction here. But sometimes, I know people say, it is difficult. How do we really bring on board? How do we really get a good feeling for this idea of impermanence, that things are unreliable? How can we actually kind of get a real gut feeling for these things, right? It's important that these things become emotional. This shouldn't just be intellectual ideas that kind of swirl around our head. How does it go deep inside of us? And one of the ways of doing that is to take notice when in your life something drastic happens. At a certain point, we all experience impermanence in a very powerful way, right? Those are the times to really reflect on these things. Wow, it really is impermanent. When those things happen, sometimes we just end up grieving. We end up becoming sad because somebody dear to us has passed away or is very ill. Some very difficult thing has happened in our life. We end up just grieving and being sad. And we forget to use this as an opportunity to also grow in wisdom. Sure, of course, very often there is going to be some grief and sadness. But also remember that there is a way of dealing with this from the point of view of Dhamma, from the point of view of Buddhism. Reflect on this. Remember, this is a fact of life. This is the way it is. And when you take that on board, when it actually is happening to you, right here, right now, it becomes very powerful. We had a very small example of this here for the whole Buddhist society. That was just a week ago. And some of you may know that there was a very senior Sri Lankan monk known as Bhante Gunaratana. He's very beloved around the world. He's very old now, almost coming to 90 years old. When kind of monks and nuns become very old, wow, they become so venerated, right? People really love the really old monks and nuns for a good reason. You've been a monk for a long time. You've got a lot of wisdom. You have shown that you have practiced this life well. Otherwise, you wouldn't have lasted so long. And he's been a monk for like 70 years or something, right? 70 years as a monk. You know, I'm not even close to getting that old myself. But so he was supposed to come to Perth, right? But of course, you are getting towards 90 years old. It is very uncertain. And we all thought he was going to come, he was going to lead a weekend retreat here. But then, just before the retreat is to happen, about 5 or 6 days before, we get an email saying, sorry, he can't come. He's been hospitalized in Sri Lanka. He's supposed to come from Sri Lanka. He actually lives in the US, but he was visiting Sri Lanka at the time. He's been hospitalized and told not to travel anywhere for a week because his health isn't quite up to it. Right? And that was because he is a very beloved in Buddhist circles. Many people in the Buddhist society here were looking forward to meeting him. He has been here before. Last time he was here was maybe 20 years ago or something. I remember meeting him myself when he was here. He's a very nice, very, very wonderful old monk, and teaches very good meditation. And people were very disappointed. But then, of course, the right way, the right attitude when that happens is to remember, of course it has to be like this. This is the nature of existence. It's unreliable. It's impermanent. It's uncertain. You have no idea what's going to happen next. I was foolish to think that he was going to come in the first place. We all fall into that trap all the time. It's impossible to avoid falling into that trap. Occasionally you may avoid it, but generally speaking, you have to fall into that trap. And then you remind yourself, I was foolish in thinking that. That's what I reminded myself. And then initially you feel a bit of sadness that he can't come. But then you let go. You think it has to be like this. He will now probably never come back to Perth. He's just too old. We'll never see him again. And when you take it on board, when you remember this is the nature of life and it sinks into you, something beautiful happens. You're letting go, right? You are letting go. You understand not only is this true for this particular situation, this is a truth for life in general. This is always the case. When you see one example like that, it has ramifications for your whole life. The letting go becomes quite big. And when you let go, something very amazing and powerful happens when you let go. When you let go, every time you let go, you feel peaceful as a consequence. Why? Because the opposite of letting go is holding on. The opposite of letting go is attaching. The opposite of letting go is desires. When you let go, all of that is gone. When you have no desires, when you have no attachments, when you have no holding on to the things of the world, you naturally feel peaceful. Desire, craving is an unpeaceful state of mind. When that is gone, you feel peaceful according to nature. It just happens. This is the power of letting go. This is the power of understanding impermanence in the right way. So it's a blessing, right? It is not suffering to go around thinking about impermanence and unreliability. It's not, oh no, everything is so unreliable. My friends are going to pass away. No. When you think about it in the right way, it's a beautiful and wonderful opportunity to let go of the world around you. And you start to feel a beautiful sense of peace inside of you. This is the real power of these teachings. And I would recommend you, when you come here to the Dhammaloka Center, or if you go to Jhana Grove or wherever it is, and you do some meditation practice for yourself, see that impermanence in action inside of yourself. Right? You sit down for a while, you start to feel more peaceful. Why is that? The reason is because you have let go of stuff. That's basically the reason. And the more peaceful you feel, the more stuff you have let go of. The less things you are thinking of, it means you have let go of those things. And when you start to get very, very peaceful, it's like you're just inside of yourself, inside your own little cocoon. It's as if the whole world outside you has disappeared. You know that feeling when that happens? You feel so safe inside of you. This is your real home, right? This is where you really belong, safe inside of yourself. And then, again, you understand the power of impermanence. All of those things that you were holding on to before, all of those things that were important to you, you have let go of them. They are gone.
And how do you feel?
Much, much, much better as a consequence. You start to see that this idea of things fading away, things being impermanent, when it is applied in the right way, is an incredible blessing in your life. It is something very beautiful, something very powerful. And that is the real lesson of impermanence. It is how we look at things that matters. If we look at impermanence in the right way, instead of being a problem that we have to fight in society, that we have to fight to stay alive because we don't want to die, instead we understand this is nature. We let go, we can become peaceful, and our life takes a turn for the better. And we start to look at life in a different way, and it becomes very, very powerful for us. Okay, so that is the talk for this evening on impermanence. Okay, so are there any questions or comments or anything else, anything anybody would like to say? There is, of course, a very well-known teaching that often is mentioned here at this time, is that if you want to be wise in the future life, you should ask questions, right? But anybody want to say anything here? Oh, over there. Okay. Hello. Great.
Hi. Thank you for the great talk. Is the paradox of impermanence that there is a permanence of peace?
There is permanence of peace? Yeah.
Impermanence and impermanence.
Okay. There isn't really, because that peace itself is a conditioned thing, right? So you're the reason why you become peaceful. You know, you might come here to the Dhammaloka Center every week, perhaps take part in the meditation, all these things. And one thing that you find out is that some weeks you actually become quite peaceful. Other weeks you're all over the place. The mind wants to think about all kind of stuff. It is so variable, right? And the reason why it works in certain weeks is because you are able to touch those right causes and conditions that give rise to peace. So peace itself is a conditioned phenomenon. It happens because you're tapping in to the right things that actually give rise to this thing in the first place. So is there any permanence in impermanence? It's interesting. Is anything at all permanent in this world? Is there anything we can rely on anything? And the Buddha actually says there are certain things that are permanent. And the things that are permanent are really the ways that nature functions. The laws of nature are really permanent. So impermanence itself is, if you like, permanent. Things are always impermanent, right? This is the way it is. Another thing which is... the Buddha says is permanent is this thing which is called dependent arising, dependent origination, which shows you how things arise in the world, in particular how suffering arises in the world based on delusion and lack of understanding. So some of the laws of how things work are always there, always the same laws, but actually the experiences we have, the experience of reality is always impermanent.
Just a question. You talked about being kind and noticing conditioning in somebody.
Yeah.
You know, when noticing the condition that has caused someone to be cruel or difficult or, you know, or even difficult to you.
Yeah.
One of the things I've found is even though I can see the conditioning, sometimes there's a need to be right in that situation.
Sure.
That there's the ego or whatever, just, you know, because this person is, it's, in some way it's affecting you or affecting me, it's very hard to sort of lean on the compassion because you feel attacked.
Yeah. Indeed, and I think it's very important to also remind ourselves that we too are conditioned, right? You are conditioned as well, and your ability to forgive somebody is very difficult in your life. Not to feel right about yourself, you know, you have to understand that this is probably the way you have to be at that particular time because of all those causes and conditions, and to forgive somebody who has been very difficult towards you is going to take time. And you have to give it time. You have to allow yourself time. This is about compassion for yourself. Don't expect too much of yourself either. As long as you're moving in the right direction, that's really all you can expect. You can't change yourself, bang, like this in one moment. That's almost impossible. That is impossible. It's a gradual path, a gradual movement. So you too are conditioned. The same compassion, understanding that you show to other people, you also have to show to yourself. You're also part of this. But sometimes it's so hard, right? Because it feels like we are in charge. It feels like we are responsible. It's very difficult to fully grasp the conditioning of ourselves. But that is also a very important part of it. So yes, you feel that you are right. And that is okay to feel that you are right. And that's perfectly, you know, at that time, that's what you have to feel. And maybe you are right, for goodness sake, you know. Might very well be the case. But by understanding your conditioning, by understanding the conditioning of the other person, and gradually deepening that, gradually, all those things will tend to settle down and disappear over time.
Thank you. I guess the good thing is, the positive thing is that in those cases I've been aware of the conditioning.
Yeah.
There's some compassion sneaking in there, even in a difficult situation.
Yeah.
It's just hard to sort of go completely with the compassion.
Sure, indeed, yeah. Well done, good. Okay. Anything else? Anybody else? Everybody happy here? Everybody is happy. That's good. Okay, thank you. Okay, so here we have some questions from overseas. This is from Chris from Germany. I would like to know if everything is uncertain and falling apart, how to find hope and still stay positive through life. Well, this is kind of the point, right? Just because it is really our attitude to the things falling apart, which is the most important one. And with the right attitude, as I was saying towards the end of my talk, it becomes a force for good instead. Because it means that you can allow you to let go of things in the world. Right? This is the beautiful thing about that. And you find so much more contentment and happiness ultimately by understanding that impermanence, by embracing it, than by trying to fight it all the time. Our world is almost about fighting impermanence. It's not going to work. You have to go with the flow. And then as you go with the flow and you allow things to be impermanent, boy, you can find so much happiness as a consequence of that. So, and also remember that, you know, one of the great things is if you are somebody who practices the Buddhist teachings, this is precisely what the Buddhist teachings are about. They are a refuge from these problems. That's why they are called the refuges, right? Sadhana, sadhanang in Pali. So you go to the Buddhist teachings. If you feel kind of sense of a despair, just read what the Buddha has to say about these things. Lift up your spirits. You feel so much better. It's not actually a cause for despair at all. Why? Because there is a solution. There is a way out. There is a way forward. So choose the way forward, and then the opposite happens. What happens is that you feel a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose, that there is a place to go, a place where you can free yourself from all those problems. So, no sense to despair. Instead, do it in the positive way. That's an important question, though, so thank you for that. This is from Indonesia, from Adri Sentosa in Indonesia. If all of this world is suffering and we should let it go, should all of us become monks? If everyone is a monk, what would the world be if everybody becomes a monk, right? Well, if everybody becomes a monk, great, wonderful, right? Then what? That would be great. If everybody wanted to practice the spiritual life to such an to the maximum, I think it's a wonderful thing. Let everybody got to become a monk. But I challenge you to try to persuade everybody in the world to become a monk. It is going to be a very tall task in persuasion to be able to do that. It's never going to happen, right? People ask this question often. What if everybody becomes a monk? But really, it is kind of a question. It's a non-starter because it's never going to happen. Not going to have everybody being monks or nuns in this world. It just doesn't happen that way. So, And in a sense, we find this already in the Buddhist community. The Buddhist community is nicely divided between monastics on the one hand and the lay community on the other, like two pillars supporting each other. And that's a wonderful thing. Maybe not everybody should be monastics. Maybe not everybody should be monks and nuns. It depends, right, how committed you are. It depends on your ability to practice this path. It depends on the commitments you have in lay life. So maybe that isn't the best way anyway, that everybody becomes a monk or nun. Maybe some people should stay as lay people. Maybe that is the fastest path for certain people. I don't know. I think ideally when the monastic life is well lived, it is by far the most powerful path, because you're fully immersed in these teachings and fully immersed in the practice. But I'm very glad we have lay people to support us, right? Otherwise, we'd be very thin up at Bodhinyana Monastery. We'd be like a bunch of skeletons up there. So it's great to see many of you coming there. You know, many of you are regulars up there. It's a wonderful thing. So we support each other. And remember that if you support the monastics and you practice as a lay person, get some joy out of that, right? It's a wonderful thing to be able to support the monastic community in their practice. It's a wonderful thing for me as a monastic to support the lay people in their practice. We are supporting each other. Isn't that a wonderful thing? And when we support each other, we grow a very strong and powerful Buddhist community as a consequence. So please don't worry about everybody becoming a monk or nun, because it ain't going to happen, let's face it. Okay, last one. This is from Maya from Slovenia. Dear Ajahn, is it right view to find good in impermanence? It is just nature, right? You can't really say that impermanence is good or bad as such. It is just the nature of things. The world is, things are impermanent. So it is just nature. And when things are in a certain way, we have to accept that. If we try to kind of say, oh, I don't want to see, oh, it's impermanent, no, don't want to see, then of course we're creating trouble for ourselves. We have to open our eyes and see things in accordance with reality. So it's neither good nor bad. We just make the best of the situation. When you understand that there is impermanence, okay, we deal with that in a different way. And one of the ways of dealing with that is by letting go. This is the powerful result of seeing impermanence in a deeper way. And you let go more and more and more. And as you let go, you find this beautiful peace inside of you as a consequence. So neither good nor bad. Just make sure you take on board these truths in your life. Then it becomes as good as it can be. Okay. So that is all for tonight. So let's just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Sāvaka Sāngho, Sāngho.